Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 368th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I am a professor from the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia in Canada.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and a professor at the University of Alberta. And here in the luxurious Edmonton studio is Dr. Tina Koronik. Tina.
Yeah, hi. Good afternoon.
You could say what you do for a living.
Oh, yes, I'm a family physician. I work at the university here. I work with Pierre.
And you put up with Mike.
Yeah.
Which is probably her main job and also the least tasteful part of it.
I thought you were going to say something about, you know, what do I do for a living? Well, I clean bathrooms. I take care of the house. Oh, yeah, and I have a job full time as a doctor as well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because this topic is near and dear to your heart.
This is. That's sleep training. Yeah, for infants.
For infants.
Yeah, that is near and dear to my heart. Yeah. I should have researched this topic about 10 years ago.
And 12 pregnancies ago.
Yeah,
just kidding.
I was gonna say there's eight children between the three of us on this podcast.
Yes.
And James and I share one.
Yes.
Wait, that had more implications.
I was gonna say, which could be interpreted in a number of ways.
Yeah.
Given that Mike is really not doing a proper job here, why don't you let us know about infant sleep training?
Okay, James. So infant sleep training. Now, the question that came up is there any evidence for infant sleep training? And I was joking when I said I should have looked at this years ago. But when I did have my children, I was too sleep deprived to think about this. Then there's hundreds of books on the market. So it came to our mind a little while ago. Adrian did this tool with me. What is the actual evidence? Are there any randomized controlled trials that look at infant sleep training? And so we decided to take a look, and we found that lo and behold, there are actually a few randomized controlled trials that look at if you implement different types of sleep training, is there a benefit? And so I'll kind of run through a couple of the trials that we found for you. The first is, they're not huge. The first one was about 235 infants. This one was out of actually Vancouver, BC. All these trials are neat in that they're done in community, sort of in primary care settings, which I really, really liked. And they didn't get a ton of press or play, but they ask a really important question. And that was, enrolling kids whose parents showed up and said, yeah, my kid has a sleep problem. And that was defined as sort of more than two awakenings a night, at least five nights a week. And so most of us would say with kids, that could be considered normal. And that was the requirement for enroll in the first trial. So the average age of the infants was about 7 months. And depending where you look, some people will say, well, at around 6 months, they should be able to sleep through the night, you know, developmentally be capable of that. So the average age was 7 months for enrollment here. And they were randomized either to a sleep training intervention or safety education. And this was through some of the public health units and really run by the nurses. So again, really practical, what we'd probably, you know, you could implement potentially elsewhere as well. And they found that the parents that received the sleep training, which was generally considered controlled crying. And so what controlled crying is this intervention where you put the baby down, try to let them soothe themselves to sleep, leave them for a couple of minutes. If they're not sleeping, go back for a minute or two, soothe them, and then leave again. And you sort of leave them with sort of increasing intervals, about 2 minutes each time, to see if they can soothe themselves and eventually settle on their own. So those kids who had the controlled crying did better on virtually every outcome they looked at. So one of the first outcomes was looking at sort of the subjective report of parents, the parents saying, my child has a severe sleep problem. Mm-hmm. And so that number in the intervention group decreased to 4 versus 14% in the education group. So number needed to treat of about 10. So one of the other outcomes that they looked at was the number of infants who had a greater than 2 diary recorded awakenings per night. So this was more of an objective outcome looking at how many awakenings did parents report? And they found that the intervention group, the sleep group, had a significant reduction. So there, about 30% of them reported two or more awakenings per night, compared to 60% in the education group. So that's a pretty big difference, almost 30%, which is a number needed to treat of about four. So those numbers are pretty impressive when we look at other interventions that we have. So the other thing that I love about this study is they looked at a lot of other outcomes around parental fatigue, parental sleep quality, and parental mood scales. And virtually every one of those outcomes was statistically significantly improved. Now, some of them might, you can quibble about, was there clinical significance? There was a couple of points improvement on a few of the scales, but the mood scales in particular were impressive. And the next study that I'll talk about, we look at that a little bit as well.
Well, first of all, I want to clarify, Tina. So you're saying that when kids are waking up at night, it can disturb the parent's sleep.
Yeah, right, which is my entire motivation for looking at this. Yeah.
So, James, did you understand that your sleep could be disturbed by a child who was crying?
No, I didn't understand that because I just let my wife deal with it.
Thank you for setting. I set that up. I laid out the red carpet. You walked on it. No, waved.
I am just kidding, but I'm sure it does to some degree affect women more than men, just because they're nicer and they care a lot more.
And they're getting up to nurse the baby and all sorts of things. But yeah, let's. I think we actually get to that though, don't we, Tina?
Well, we do actually. Yeah, we do certainly get to that in the next study here a little bit, which I'll talk about. So a second RCT looking at 328 families. Again, the families came in and said, my infant has a sleep problem. Mean age, again, was about 7 months. So this seems to be a common theme through a lot of these studies. And they were randomized to a tailored sleep intervention with sleep training or usual care. And again, these were in sort of public health units. This study was completed in Australia. And what they found is the group that received the sleep training at 10 months had a significant reduction in infant sleep problems, 56% versus 68% usual care. So your number needed to treat is 9. And the other thing that they looked at was depression. So overall, there was a reduction that wasn't statistically significant in mothers. So severe depression was 28% versus 35%. But what they found is subgroup analysis is those moms who were actually depressed, who actually had a baseline score of 9 or more on the depression scale, they had a statistically significant and clinically significant improvement in depression if their babies underwent the sleep training.
Now, I'm sure some people are saying, well, you know, it's not statistically significant and all that sort of stuff. And really, I mean, it is nice when it is significant, but when it comes to these sort of secondary outcomes, it's nice just to see that at least the stuff is going in the right direction.
Yeah, you know, it makes sense, right? This is this kind of internal validity that you're looking for. Like, so people who are frustrated by their children waking up so frequently, the kids are sleeping a little bit better. The reports from parents about their sleep problems is better. But is it showing out in secondary outcomes? Like if a pain study, we would be looking at attendance of work and use of other pain medicines and all that kind of thing. In this case, the secondary outcome here is what is the mood and quality of life factors of these moms and parents. And this is to me, this is a very positive thing. Again, I'm not so worried about statistically significant. I'm impressed that it's having an effect likely in that area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's huge because we all know we've seen young moms in our clinic with babies who aren't sleeping, and sometimes they're ready to lose their marbles, right? They're just, and that can show itself in sort of depression type symptoms. So if there's anything we can do to help with that. Interestingly enough, they did do another subgroup analysis, speaking to James's earlier point, where they look, if you had two caregivers, so they included families with one primary caregiver or two caregivers. The primary, out of those two, there's always one sort of primary caregiver, and then there's sort of the secondary. And mood scales improved for the primary caregiver, but not for the secondary caregiver.
not a surprise as much. Yeah,
exactly.
No, because it's the, you know, the whoever's getting up the most, and typically that's the mom without putting too fine a sexist point on it. It's usually the mom for a host of reasons. And it would be natural that if anyone having the most eroded sleep and therefore feeling stressed and having trouble with mood, it would be the mom. I mean, she's just, it is tiring. I often will say to moms when they come to me and complain about fatigue, which is a common complaint we hear, and I'll say, how many kids do you have? That's one of the questions that I have. How much time do you get to yourself to do fun things? How much sleep do you get a night? Those kind of issues. But they didn't rest there, did they, Tina? They kind of went on and did even more, like, follow-up with these families.
Yeah, which I really like. So some of the researchers, they followed these guys that not just, you know, the original 6 weeks or 3 months. They actually followed them 2 and 5 years out. And at 2 years, one of the things that they found in the Australian study is that there was a sustained reduction in depressive symptoms in the intervention group. So with a number needed to treat of 9. So about 15% of primary caregivers had depressive symptoms in the intervention group versus about 26% in the other group. And then they followed them at 5 years, which I think is fascinating, because if you read around this topic, it reminds me of other topics that we've looked at before, but there's quite a sort of dichotomy of how people feel about this. And some people really feel strongly that letting your baby cry has a potential to emotionally damage them down the road and interfere with attachment and different things. And so that's why this group, they looked at 5 years out, and they actually looked at over 20 different outcomes, looking at child behavior, relationships, maternal, mental health, sort of adjustment disorders. Was there anything that sort of, you know, affected these children or the parents down the road? And interestingly enough, not one of those 20 outcomes showed any statistically significant difference.
At 5 years.
Yeah, at 5 years, right? So no evidence of long-term harm. And you can also say no evidence of long-term benefit. So no one was still less depressed at 5 years. But so what we see is evidence of short-term benefit, and then the limited evidence we have showing no long-term harms associated with that. So, and this data is supported by a few other smaller studies. There are some systematic reviews that have been done that look at sleep training interventions. And they seem to consistently show some benefit in infant sleep and benefit in parental depressive symptoms, which is awesome, because the numbers you're getting are similar to what we'd need with SSRIs.
Sometimes. Oh, for sure. These are the numbers. Number needed to treat around 10 often, right? For kind of a mild to moderate depression for an antidepressant. So it's not the and for something as simple as helping your child sleep more, knowing that from the best available data we have, there is no sign that this causes any long-term consequences.
Right. Yeah.
It can be stressful when you're doing it,
yeah.
Right? Like for those of us who've done these routes, and there's, as Tina said, there's so many different names to these. I remember the one that we had looked up when my wife and I were at that kind of 6 months to 9 month window and talking about killing each other.
Yeah. But the first one was giving up the child for adoption, which actually works immediately.
It's wonderful.
Yeah.
We've had 7 kids and we have 2 at home. Mm-hmm. One of them was called a love technique, because you would go back in and tell the child, you loved your child. Right. I love you, but we you're making mom and dad get up every night, 3 to 4 times a night. It's just too much, honey. So we're going to leave you in bed. Or these kind of things.
And you know, for sure as heck, they're hearing the tone of your voice going, I don't hear the love.
I don't hear the love. That. And then I would go drink more alcohol and no. No, but these are hard things to do for the first while. And our second child, I remember we went through a number of these attempts.
Right.
She was much stronger willed than I was. She beat us down. So anyway, Tina, tell us some more about the context of this.
Yeah. So, all right. A couple of things in line with that. So we talked about this is controlled crying. There's various techniques. There's something called complete extinction, where you just put the baby and let them cry. Actually, there is some evidence that that is also effective. Although when they've sort of surveyed parents tend to find this method a lot more stressful. And yeah, I will admit we did try this with our kid, and it's very stressful.
We've tried this with James.
Yeah.
typically during most podcasts.
Put him in a room, let him try and cry it out.
Just don't come
but
back.
But God, like sometimes we're on an hour and a half and we come back and still.
Yeah.
But you know, everybody has their time, James. So
yeah, that's right. And so what do we, I mean, this is a similar with adults, but if kids don't get enough sleep, we know that they're, is an association with parental depression, psychological distress, and worse actual parental health. So that idea of where, you know, you're not just helping your baby, you're potentially helping yourself.
And then the baby in the cycle, right? Because if you're feeling better, you've got more time and energy for the baby. It's actually a cycle that positively feeds on itself. And if it's in the negative where the baby's waking up all the time and you're not addressing the issue, then it has a negative cycle where it just wears you down and then you have less enthusiasm for picking up the child and etc.
Yeah, and it's interesting actually, we didn't have room for it in the tool, but there is some more survey type of data that suggests that moms who are chronically sleep deprived are more likely to be physically abusive towards their babies and verbally abusive towards their babies. So there's some evidence around that too. So this is, you know, sort of trying to counter that. And then also the evidence looking at infants who are well rested seem to have an easier temperament, a little more adaptable, less distractible. So lots of really good things.
And I think the comment, I was just going to say, the comment that you make of, you know, it's, you know, whether it's 2 or 5 minutes, but at least it feels like you're doing something active versus just being completely, you know, jerky and just not going in there at all.
Yeah. Right.
You know, so I think, like I said, that's you know, it seems to me that that would, even if they were shown to be equally effective, you still may wish to do this other version because, you know, just it probably feel, like you said, it's less stressful.
Right. Yeah. It's fascinating, though. One of my friends said to me one time, one of my good friends said to me that power goes in reverse order of size in a house. And this is a classic example of this. This little person who's new to the house, maybe 6 months into the house, still has a very dominant effect on everybody's sense of well-being. And so we have to, you can't obviously turn that around because they still will always be the power in the house. But to get some of that back a little bit after 6 months, I think is quite reasonable and also important for the health of moms. But this, mm-hmm. Tina, years ago, you and I looked at a study that was of a drug for infant sleep. And I can't remember much about that off the top of my head. It was, I believe, diphenhydramine, was it not?
Yes, it was. Yeah, it was.
It was diphenhydramine, and the study was stopped early because it was so, the effects were so profound.
Because it had the opposite effect of what they were expecting.
Diphenhydramine actually worsened kids' sleep, didn't improve it. It worsened kids' sleep. Not to mention the fact that those drugs should not be given to kids under the age of 6, etc. Yeah. 6 years, much less 6 months.
Yeah. And those products have been in, you know, being put in cough and cold remedies, and all that sort of stuff. And it's always been an anecdote, but it seems to be borne out by the literature that even though most people, especially adults, will be sedated by an antihistamine. There are children who get the sort of the reverse of it. They get quite stimulated by it, and it sounds like that was borne out by that study.
Just, you know, two real big take-home messages there. They're not safe for kids. They're associated with increased admission to hospital, infant death, all sorts of things. But on top of it, they don't even work. They do the opposite of what you're hoping. So, you know, this is a great example where drugs are not the solution at all. Mm-hmm. The solution to this issue is this sleep training thing.
Yeah, which I think it's fascinating because this is sort of something we don't typically say learn in med school. I never learned about this. It's something we kind of had to dig up, but has huge potential impact for some of our patients, because I certainly do see a lot of young moms who, one, come in and they can't figure out why they're tired, but they have.
I know, you feel terrible because they're so tired that they haven't even had a chance to cognitively reflect,
exactly,
why am I tired? Because their brain is really getting battered.
Yeah, they're sleep deprived, as you said, and many other things.
And the stress of taking care of a new child and all sorts of things. So, this is a really important thing that we can do for our parents. And if you're in family medicine and you haven't you know, you've been in practice for over a year and you haven't had a mom come in and ask about what can be done, then you're probably not actually in family practice.
Yeah.
You're in radiology.
No wonder it's so dark in there.
And what's really cool is it's based on, you know, reasonably well-designed clinical trials. You can't blind these sorts of things, but as best one can do, there's at least an evidence base around it.
Yeah, I mean, these are, you know, they're a fair amount above a survey study or a questionnaire or that kind of thing, cross-sectional research. So this is as good as it's going to get. And it's we often say that and imply that the research isn't good, but this is two trials of reasonable size with over 200 kids, one in over 300 kids. So yeah, I mean, this is pretty good research, and I think it's pretty safe to have this approach. But
and clearly not, with numbers needed to treat of 9, it means, again, the vast majority of people aren't benefiting it, but at least it gives you an option.
Yeah, and for the kids, though, some of the good number needed to treats are 4, right?
Yeah, 30%. So it's pretty impressive, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Versus 60, so.
Cool. So anything else on this one, or are we just about, we don't have to cry anymore about this one?
Hopefully we didn't put anyone to sleep. This could be the be the option for it.
Ooh, right? Nice.
The alternative.
Yeah. Option 2 is play the Best Science Medicine podcast in the child's room.
They'll be out before you know it.
Yeah, they'll be out, and they won't be coming to for 10 hours. I got very worried about my child. I was playing the Best Science Medicine podcast.
Yeah. Well, we have had some listeners let us know that they play our podcast in the car with their children, and we've decided that's a form of torture.
That's a punishment. Mm-hmm. You can stand in the corner for 3 hours or listen to the podcast for
20
minutes.
Yeah, with dad in the car or mom in the car. Yeah. So anything else on this?
All right. No, I don't think so.
No, I think that's the key points right there, yeah.
Well, great job by you and Adrian on this one. It's like I said, it answers a useful clinical question. So as always, go check out, there's many, many other great tools for practice, and you can find those just by Googling tools for practice. It comes right up. And you guys are still producing these every 2 weeks. I'm sure you take a little bit of time off over the holidays, but you've just done some great stuff with marijuana. And by that, again, I mean a tools for practice. Our Best Science Medicine course is coming up in May 4th and May 5th in Vancouver. I am going to be posting in the next couple of days, I think I've been saying this for a while, but the actual program. So we would love it if you could attend that. Go to our website on a regular basis. Please leave comments on iTunes if you would like to do that, and let people know about the podcast if you like it. Anything else, Mike, you want to sell? Any of your seven children?
Which have all moved away.
Yes. Nothing?
No, that's good, James. Okay. Thanks.
Thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.